Hello once again, and welcome back to the quest for 10,000, one man's humble journey to watch 10,000 movies before he turns 40. I'm your host, Ben.
And I'm Brian.
And we're so glad that you are back for our second episode. Thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading. Thank you, hopefully, for sharing this with other friends to listen and to respond to.
And laugh at.
And mainly laugh at us and maybe some of the things that we say you'll also find amusing. This is our second episode. In our inaugural episode, we talked a little bit about the origins of Brian's quest to watch 10,000 movies before he turns 40. And he has about 4 years and change before that happens. And so we continue in this episode to talk about what is it, according to you, Brian, that defines something as a movie, something that you would accept in the list of your 10,000, and what would not count as a movie.
Well, there are some, like, you know, nuts and bolts kind of definitions. If you don't have an IMDb page, I don't care.
You know, what would be something that wouldn't have an IMDb page?
Stuff that my friends and I made. So I'm not counting those movies.
You're not counting movies that you might have seen at a movie festival.
Yeah, something like that. Well, festival films would be fine because most of those will wind up having IMDb pages. But you know, like when I was involved in a thing called the Sidewalk Scramble, and we would make a film over a weekend, and then we'd put it on, you know, show it at a theater here in town. I wouldn't count any of those.
You wouldn't count any of those, okay. And we'll talk more about Sidewalk Scramble and some of your experience, and mine, actually, in making some films as well. So you have to have an IMDb page. Mm-hmm. What else do you feel like would have to be a criteria for it being a movie? Does it have to be a certain length to be considered a movie? Okay, so tell, like, what... short movies would be counted.
Yeah, I mean, I'm counting movies from 1900, some movies from the 19th century, a few, like 18, and those are like 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay, all right. You couldn't get done with this if you didn't have it, right?
My favorite movie from 1900 is called Explosion of a Motor Car. Now, this film, it's like 3 minutes, and it is, they're not trying to trick you.
The title is not misleading.
The title is pretty much, you know what's going to happen. This is a static camera, this car drives around the corner, and it's coming closer, and all of a sudden, for no discernible reason, it explodes.
Nice.
Then the camera kind of cuts, and next thing you know, there are what appear to be limbs of the people from the car.
All right.
Just lying all in right. the middle of the street.
There you go.
And I'm not sure what, I mean, mm-hmm. it's not gory, it's just, you know, I'm not sure what they thought was going to happen mm-hmm. with automobiles mm-hmm. or how exactly they were wrong. They clearly had some...
Clearly, there was some subtext. So things like Charlie Chaplin films, those type of things would count. Buster Keaton. What about things like the Bugs Bunny cartoons, like that that used to be in the movies?
Count them.
Okay. Count them. And that leads to another thing. Both you and I have young children, kids under the age of 5. And there's a lot of things that they watch on the TV. And usually there'll be very special episodes of, say, Jake and the Neverland Pirates or Doc McStuffins or things like that. Those made-for-TV movies, kids' movies.
I do watch the made-for-TV and count them. I counted Brian's song. I counted Look What's Happened to Rosemary's Baby, Don't Ask. I counted Psycho
Noted.
4, also Don't Ask. I have not seen them, but I anticipate at some point in the future watching and counting the Tinkerbell movies. So I will, you know, the line is loose. The line is loose. It's not a very short
But in general, would it be like, I mean, after we get done recording, I could show you the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse movies. We could watch one of those in about an hour.
Well, I'm asking,
would you count it or
so
not?
So far, okay. When I was a child, Facts of Life. You remember the TV show? They had a special episode called "The Facts of Life Down Under."
Right.
I loved it when I was a kid. I have not yet put it on my list or counted it. I don't think I should. Mm. I don't think I should mm-hmm. count the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island.
Oh, you've got to count that one. The robots playing basketball? It's amazing. That's an amazing piece of work. That belongs in the Smithsonian, young man. Well, what about... okay, well, here's another one. You should probably put... It would be on my list. It is on my list. Maybe the only chance I have of even being close to the 5,000-plus movies you've seen now. Saved by the Bell, Wedding in Vegas.
Made-for-TV movie. Wedding in Vegas.
Zach and Kelly get married. It's
amazing.
Oh, I know
what happened. Yeah. I think it's self-explanatory. Okay. But,
yeah, but it's right there.
I'm not.
Okay, documentaries, I'm guessing.
Oh,
you
sure.
count.
Gotta count documentaries.
All right, 30 for 30s and those sorts 30 of things.
30 shorts.
And 30 for
those.
30 shorts, too.
Oh,
all
yeah,
right.
Count them.
All right, yeah, count those. Yeah. Now here's an interesting debate, maybe a little bit. So much of TV, not just kids' TV, but TV in general has become much more cinematic, I think was a word you
sure.
used earlier when we talked about this. Things like The Sopranos, Games of Thrones, Breaking Bad. Just these TVs have made a golden age of TV. And in many ways, each season of those particular shows tell a pretty tight narrative in and of itself. But you say you would not count TV shows in a general rule, even those that have a cinematic aspect to them.
I don't. In general, no. I don't count.
Okay.
I'm torn about some of them I would like. Now, having said that, you know, there are... some exceptions, but on the whole, I'm pretty firm. It's not a bright line, but if I look at something, and I say that's TV. I don't count.
It's TV. You don't count. Which makes sense. This is the quest for 10,000 movies, not 20,000 TV shows.
You know, we can go to and something. I may change my mind on some things.
And of course, something like the Simpsons movie, which was released in theaters.
Definitely counts as
Sex and the City movies,
which I have not seen because I haven't watched all of the TV shows.
Right, but you know, maybe what about things that are straight to video? Maybe they have an IMDb page. They don't necessarily have to have a theatrical release though for you to necessarily consider them.
Well,
a movie.
I watched the two sequels to Aladdin.
Mm-hmm.
Watched both of those, and
one was good, one was not.
True. Neither one were great.
Yeah, that's true too.
Let's be fair.
Yeah.
don't give them too much credit here.
Yeah.
You know. And
sure.
A lot of that was, you know, Robin not participating.
He was in the third one. That's the good one.
And the third one was much better.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's helpful to kind of know what we're dealing with. Maybe that's obvious to most people. TV wouldn't be movies, but still, I think that's an interesting conversation.
But even now, we're talking about there's not a line. Like, what is, you know. There are things now, the movies that are released on TV, because they're released on Netflix or Hulu or Amazon Prime, I guess they'll get into it soon, that never got a theatrical release.
Right.
So.
Right. Well, and that's another good thing. You mentioned earlier in the first episode,
iCheckMovies.com.
We've mentioned IMDb a couple of times. This quest would be pretty much impossible without those type
imagine.
Of sites.
I can't imagine. Such a
doing that, just enabling you just to help count and keep track of things, to suggest things.
There have been times where my count has been off.
Ease of access.
And when that happens, it takes, it's frustrating, and it takes some time to rectify. It can be a nightmare.
Sure. And that's something else we'll want to talk more about. How do you keep organized and on task with all the movies you think you've seen? One other question I meant to ask you last time, Brian, and just kind of ran out of time. Basically, I just forgot. But still good now, even early on in this process. If you could share the first real memory of watching a movie that you have.
Okay. I remember going to see on a re-release Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I want to say it was the Alabama Theater. And this, I could not have been more than six, maybe younger. I do remember that. I remember that was a big deal. It felt like a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I couldn't have comprehended or remember watching the movie from that time, seeing enough now that maybe it conflates with that memory and I can't, you know. But I remember that. I remember my father and mother taking me to go see Return of the Jedi. And I don't remember much of that experience other than being there and just the bigness of it, you know, going to the movie. We've lost a little bit of that, of going to the movies is not as big an experience as mm-hmm. it was maybe mm-hmm. even into the 80s and into the 90s.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do remember those experiences.
Yeah. So Return of the Jedi, those sorts of things. Yeah, my experience of first movies is similar. I remember E.T., I remember Bambi. I remember Cinderella.
Mm-hmm.
I remember just snippets of all those movies. I remember having to leave before those movies were done because I was young and got antsy and fidgety sort of thing. Well, I remember popcorn, though, always tasting better.
Well, do you remember, when we were kids...
Soda always tasting a little bit more thirst-quenchingly good.
Even up until the middle of our childhood, probably, there were no... VHS tapes were not as common. DVDs were not.
Laser discs. They were all laser discs.
All this stuff didn't exist. And Disney was one of the only people that would, but Disney would make a habit of re-releasing mm-hmm. the classics every so often.
Right.
Just to get you hooked, in essence, on their product. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. that was a big deal.
Yeah.
And like your parents or somebody in your family that remembered seeing that movie when they were a kid wanted to go and take you to so you could see it with them. We've lost a little bit of that because of the ubiquitousness of, you know, access to these mm-hmm. films that we didn't have then. Mm-hmm. If you didn't see theaters, you didn't see it.
Right.
But
I think I'll actually say though, I think my first movie, maybe I went to see this. Maybe I'm remembering this story wrong, but I know that my older brother was about four. I was about one. They took him to see Empire Strikes Back. And I would have been in a stroller. And they may have taken me into the theater, too, and I kind of fell asleep during the movie or something like that. But that was also an early experience. So it's kind of interesting that both of our early memories revolve around Star Wars, especially with Episode 7.
Well, I don't think you could be a young child in the 80s, an infant or toddler, and not have some kind of, especially a boy. I don't know about girls. I think some girls managed to, like, sneak through and avoid it altogether. But I think every boy... that was, you know, 6 or 7 or younger when Return came out, their childhood had to have been impacted.
and even sooner. And what I do remember is even sitting down, ABC, NBC, CBS, they would show movies of the week. The first broadcast telecast of Star Wars, A New Hope. Oh. And sitting down and watching that and just being impressed with that.
I don't like calling it Star Wars.
Well, I know you don't like calling it that, but
I'm calling it Star Wars.
Right.
That was the name of the movie.
That was the name of the original name of the movie. So that is duly noted. Another question that occurred to me also while you were sharing about those first movies that I didn't get a chance to ask you this either. Why did you decide on 40 as being the milestone for 10,000 movies?
40 has always felt like a significant number. I mean, I think, some of that stuff explanatory. I think everybody kind of feels some sort of like passing of time, or some sort of milestone when you hit 40 years. Because it forces you to reflect on your previous 40 years in a way that maybe turning 36 doesn't, turning 25 doesn't. But in my particular case, my father was 39 when he died, and my mother's father was 39 when he died. So it becomes sort of a like symbolic way of thinking of them, or thinking of my mortality, their mortality, or everything. And that's part of the reason. That's the reason why.
Well, and that's, I think, part of what film movies can do for us too. We've already talked about that also, how they can impact our sense of life and the possibilities, and maybe in the case like Geely of the horrible kind of missed opportunities, we'll say,
when you watch a horrible movie, you know, it doesn't make me mad per se, but it does make me pause and think how many people, how many man hours, how much effort, how much money went into making this.
Yeah.
The enormous amount of like...
Not enough in quality control.
It astounds me that much effort and that much human capital went into something that can be that bad.
Right. That's why I'm not putting much effort into this podcast. Okay. So that,
fair enough.
So that people won't have that same reaction.
Full disclaimer,
to us.
No effort.
I won't say no effort. I'm just not.
Minimal,
you know,
effort.
Minimal. It's the least. The very
we don't
least
want you,
we can do.
Do not raise your expectations
to be able
them
to get
lower.
To be able to get through this. So,
thank you.
So we'll move on now. After that deeply introspective part, maybe something a little more lighthearted. And last time you shared about two movies, Brian, Geely, which we mentioned, and the name of the other one was
Polytechnique.
Polytechnique with a powerful message, but kind of
a
depressing kind of overall narrative.
Yeah, no,
and Geely was Geely, which is just enough to say. So tell me then about a movie that you've seen recently that was just maybe delightful on all levels.
Well, okay, the one that was delightful, this I saw it maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago now. I went into it with absolutely no expectations. Did not think it was going to be anything I would enjoy. But, you know, it was something we could watch as a family. So we watched Paddington, based on Paddington, you know, the books that I never really read when I was a kid. I mean, I was aware of them. But
he ate porridge, doesn't
he?
Porridge?
Ate marmalade.
Marmalade,
I think it's orange marmalade, but it's particularly marmalade.
Marmalade.
He's from deep, darkest Peru. It reminded me of like the style of Wes Anderson in a way. It had that kind of quirky, huge attention to detail that mattered in its set design and just the look of the film. The feel of it felt like Amelie, which was just this overwhelming, like just not quirkiness per se, but a sense of like bemusement with everything.
Yep.
Like everything was, there was a joke hidden everywhere. And it was really good.
How was the Lord of Downton Abbey?
He was very good. I really enjoyed him. Sally Hawkins, who is not a name that most people really are familiar with, but she's had a pretty substantial career. She was in Blue Jasmine, and she was in the most recent winner of the Academy Award for Best Short Film. She was very good in it. She was the mom. Nicole Kidman was probably the worst thing in the movie. She was a little over the top. But the role was a little over the top. And it was no worse than her... Yeah. It was better than what she did in The Golden Compass.
And so would you say your enjoyment was kind of equally the movie itself being better than you thought it might be?
Oh, yeah.
But also given just the reaction of the people you were watching
it with. Yeah, watching it with my son was really fun because it was a particular scene where the bear is trying to, he's in the bathroom doing something, and the bathroom floods, and they open the door, and he comes falling out in his bathtub. He just thought that was the funniest thing.
He thought it was funny.
Just giggling, and he didn't really want to watch it. He wanted to do something else, but I said, no, we're going to watch this, and... He enjoyed it, and that made me enjoy it more. But I think I would have liked it as much without him. But it made it something special.
So Paddington Bear, good with a kid or without a kid.
I thought
a kid to watch it with in a non-creepy way.
Yes, please.
If you can't, just watch it yourself.
Yes, if you can't, do not choose to find it in a creepy way. We do not know.
That's right. We do not endorse that.
No.
At all.
Absolutely
not.
Let's make that clear.
Let's make that very clear.
Let's be clear.
We do not endorse that. but we do endorse you watching some other good movies, and we do endorse you giving us feedback on what movies you like, and one of the best ways to do that is to respond to the different top five lists that Brian will be sharing.
So, Brian, it's our second episode. It's a sequel to our first episode. So why don't you give me and our listeners your top five sequels?
Okay. Clocking in at number five. It's the end of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Return of the King. That's number five.
Return of the King, number five. A sequel to a sequel.
Yeah. And really a planned portion of one really long movie, because it's difficult to say if they really count as sequels because they were filmed concurrently as if it was like one 9-hour movie that just split up into three. But I'm counting it. Return of the King is number five.
What makes it number five for you?
Well, it's an emotional story. It's got an epic fantasy battle. Hobbits. So, cute little hobbits.
Cute little hobbitses.
So, you can't really...
You can't really go wrong with it. And my favorite film in that trilogy, I love the that scene when they all bow to the hobbits. Just very powerful.
I would have thought that, you know, before I started... I would have thought The Two Towers might have been better because I really liked that movie. But the series just kept getting better.
It just kept getting better, and it just kind of, you know, all build, mm-hmm. crescendo.
The only thing I will say is that the end of the movie did feel like a bit of a hour-long tease of like, it's over.
Well, that's probably what keeps it not being higher on the top five sequels of all time. So what is number four?
Number four is Before Sunset.
And I haven't seen that film. It's which is a recurring theme, probably, of
Richard,
this podcast.
It's Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. Richard Linklater, the director of Boyhood and Dazed and Confused, which are probably the two that everyone's seen. The first movie was 1994. It was about two fresh out of college students, one American student who's going to Europe, who meets a French girl, and they spend the night just kind of talking, and during the course of that, they sleep together. But then, for whatever reason, they have to part ways. Well, this movie occurs 7 years later, and coincidentally came out 7 years later, and it's about how they reconnect and how that one night has impacted both of their lives.
Now, Richard Linklater, did he do Boyhood also?
He
Is
did
that the
Boyhood,
same guy?
Yeah.
So he likes doing these things in real time.
He does.
And he also likes Ethan Hawke a lot,
well, I mean,
apparently.
I think part of the idea for Boyhood, or part of... maybe not the idea, but part of the reality that it could work came from his experience doing Before Sunrise, then Before Sunset, and then the most recent one that they filmed Before Midnight with the same two, Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke. Ethan Hawke's best work.
Part of a trilogy that makes your top five list. Moving on, though, now to number three.
It's also part of a trilogy, although most of us would rather forget it. It's The Godfather Part Two.
Now, when you say part of the trilogy, you mean most people would want to forget part three.
Yes. Most people would like to...
Right. That stunned me a little bit because The Godfather Part Two, many people think, is the best movie of
it
all
is,
time.
It is certainly on that list. I prefer The Godfather. I think Part Two gets a little muddied, although certainly it has some of the best moments in any movie.
I tend to agree with you on that one, and this may be a place where listeners will... disagree. I find The Godfather Part Two kind of long, kind of boring.
I can understand.
And
that.
I actually greatly prefer the ending sequence in Part One to Part Two, even though Part Two is incredibly powerful.
There are moments in Part Two that the stuff between Fredo and Michael is so pliable and so applicable to all these other situations that it's constantly referenced and used because it's just such a big moment. And so easy to like use as a metaphor for something. In some ways, it's sort of lazy at this point, but it's very easy to see that as being like, "Oh, you're my Fredo." That's why we see it all the time.
So. I knew it was you, Fredo.
Yeah.
And you know, the whole trilogy, Michael's descent, and just how deep he would go, in the hopes of getting his family out. A great film, top two or one
how
either.
They contrast Vito's, you know, rise in the world to Michael's rise, and they show the similarities in the way in which both these people, who were not bad people, and how they got immersed in this world.
But isn't it weird? You tend to root for Vito more than Michael. That's an interesting thing that happens in those movies. Maybe it's just the cuddliness of Marlon Brando,
or in the second movie, Robert De Niro versus Al Pacino.
Maybe that's it too. But I agree. As I said, Godfather Part Two is a wonderful movie. Would make my top five sequels, but wouldn't be number one on my list either.
Well, I had The Godfather above it.
Right. Yeah. Prove that. So number two.
Number two, another part of a series, although it was the official first sequel, and that is Star Wars Episode V: The Empire Strikes Back.
Nice. Now I again. Would have to agree with you there. It's one of the best sequels of all time. It's probably the first movie.
One of the best movies of all time.
It's a killer. And some would say. I don't remember if I mentioned this in the last episode or not, but that was, I think, the first movie that I was ever remotely kind of close to seeing. I was a baby. I know my brother saw it. I can't remember if I actually went in the theater or not, but I know it's one that was one of the first experiences I may have ever had, whether I actually saw it on the screen or not.
Yeah, it's hard to remember now because we live in a world where every movie is part of a franchise. I mean, every movie is made in some ways with the idea for setting up the next movie. And very few movies are made just to be closed and just we're done with it. And up until, I mean, they had always done this, always done series and you know, serials which would feature recurring characters. But this movie, coupled with Godfather Part II a couple years earlier, was part of a trend towards just ever-growing idea of seeing your movies as being continuously producing franchises.
Continuing producing that way, but also the thing I would add, and what makes these sequels better than the multitude of other sequels we get in our cinemas every summer, it seems, is that all of these sequels try to tell a new story or a new thread of the story. They might continue narratives, but it's not like something like, say, for instance, The Hangover, where they're just doing the same movie in a new context, new setting.
Exactly the same. Right. Or Pitch Perfect 2. I mean, which is exactly, in so many ways, the same movie, including some of the same songs, but now it's different because it has a 2. Because
they're a little older.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I with this movie, one thing it did, that maybe The Godfather Part 2 did as well, but what Empire did is it reimagined the first movie and made you watch it through a completely different lens only 3 years later. Because you can't watch the original Star Wars the same way after you've seen Empire and all of a sudden you're, that's his dad? What? You know, changes the whole thing.
And in a way, maybe that the end of A New Hope didn't do, Empire says, oh, there's more to this story.
Yeah.
There's more going to happen. There's another one coming.
Well, the first Star Wars, New Hope, certain, which I don't really like calling New Hope, but the first movie had elements of open-endedness to it. I mean, Darth goes flying off into the, and you don't know what happened to him. So it certainly, it didn't exclude there being other stories, but it certainly with the ribbon ceremony and everybody, you know, the celebration, it certainly implied this is the end of this story.
Right. So a sequel may be unexpected in some ways and sort of maybe the first in a trend again, showing you that there's more to come.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another part of the story to be demanded. And again, that might be what distinguishes it from Godfather Part 2 and why it's higher on your list because, again, Godfather Part 2 is sort of the same way. It's kind of a self-contained part of that particular narrative. So what comes in now, Brian, as number one?
Well, this is a personal choice. And speaking of movies that don't lend themselves very well to picking up the story and moving on, this is definitely a final chapter. And it is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Now, this is one of your favorite movies of all time. It's like
is.
Near, is it in your top 10?
I don't know if it's top 10, but it is certainly top 25.
Certainly. Yeah, and some would even say, so it's the Deathly Hallows Part 2, so we're getting really meta with the sequels here. So a sequel to a sequel.
Well, it is Part 2.
So it is sort of the quintessential sequel. So even that alone almost puts it near the top 5 of sequels for you. What makes this one so good? Better than all the other Harry Potter sequels there could have been.
I think it's the end of a very rich emotional journey. I think there's a lot of spiritual lessons in Harry Potter, a lot of like self-sacrifice, a lot of questions about friendship and loyalty and love and what makes a hero, and is that a burden or is it a blessing? Looking at Neville and Harry, look at the two paths they took, look at Severus. There's so much richness to the story, and at the end of this is what the 20th hour. Of the series, you're sort of exhausted, but at the same time you are, happy to see where all these characters wind. There's a little heartache along the way, but it's just epic in scope.
Just epic in scope, and I agree, one of the best sequels.
And
of all time.
When I first heard of the Harry Potter books, and I think this is probably a a similar scenario to most people my age, which is, you know, middle-aged or younger middle-aged. I was 20-something years old, and I had about book four is when I heard, when it sort of got on my radar as being something that was more than just something for children. And I started hearing adults defend it and talk about it and say, oh, I love it and all that. And, you know, at first I was a little skeptical, but then when you read the books, yes, the first book is definitely a children's book, but by book three and book four, and same thing for the movies, it turns into on par with Lord of the Rings or any other fantasy, Game of Thrones even, so it's on par with those.
So there you have it, folks. Brian's top five sequels list. Agree? Disagree? Go to Twitter at 10kmovies or visit Brian's blog, 10kmovies.com. Until next time, I hope your week is a 10.
10 plus.
Borderline 11. Have a good one, everybody.